Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Tracy Kidder's new book, A Truck Full of Money, chronicles the life of Paul English, a kinetic and unconventional inventor, philanthropist, and entrepreneur suffering from bipolar disorder, who co-founded the travel website Kayak, which sold for almost $2 billion. Kidder's profile of English could be considered an almost sequel to his groundbreaking book, The Soul of a New Machine, about a team of engineers that built a new computer's hardware. Again, the name of the new book is A Truck Full of Money, One Man's Quest to Recover from Great Success. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Tracy Kidder to The Book Show. Always good to have you on the program.
Well, it's good to be here, Joe.
A sequel, I assume, was not in your mind when this idea first floated your way.
Well, it sort of was. I'd written that book, The Soul of a New Machine. I think it was published in 81, and a lot has changed since then. I kind of fled from the subject. When I finished that book and it won these prizes and so on, I think there were a lot of people who seemed to think that I knew a lot about computers, and they seemed to think that I was going to write about them forever. Wrong on both counts. I wanted to go on exploring the world. And so I left that subject far behind. The hardest thing in my life, Joe, has always been what to do next. I grant you that if that's the hardest thing about your life, your working life, it's not such a hard life.
Well, for a writer, it can be an issue.
It was an issue. And it was an issue again not so long ago, about four years ago. And I thought, well, why don't I take a look at this world again? I'd tried other things. I'd looked into other possibilities. And I knew this guy. He was a member of the board of an organization I'd written about, Partners in Health, Dr. Paul Farmer's organization. I'd written a book called Mountains Beyond Mountains about Farmer. And anyway, this Paul English, had been a hotshot programmer. I knew that. I didn't know too much about his day job, but I knew he'd been one of the founders of Kayak. And he agreed to show me around. And then after a while, I thought he should be my subject, actually, because as his life began to unfold for me, his former life and what he was doing now, it just seemed like such a fascinating guy. And there was conflict, and it was troubled. It looked like a good story. It's that simple. You know, I just look for good stories.
Keeping with the idea of it being a sequel, of looking at the inside of the hardware of a computer to what ultimately the computer now gives us.
Right. Well, you know, it's changed so much. And if I had thought of it as a sequel, and, you know, now I'm going to do software as opposed to hardware 30 years later, well, I mean, I was a little late because it is all software now in a sense. I mean, the software is the hardware. A lot of this world, as I understand it, a lot of the world of creating new things in computing is a question of taking these magic black boxes and putting them together. As one person, the analogy one person used was, it's more like plumbing than hydrology anymore. But I did, in the course of this, get, you know, there are people who have to make these magic black boxes. One of the most fun things I got to do on this whole little journey was a sort of side trip. That's often the case with my research. I ended up getting an interview with a man named Donald Knuth, who is certainly one of the greatest living computer scientists, maybe some people say the progenitor of computer science. He's a tremendous programmer in his own right, but he's also a very lucid writer. Anyway, he's in his 80s. He's a professor emeritus at Stanford, still working hard on his magnum opus, and I had a great chance to talk with him. He has a theory, or a hypothesis, really, that he claims comes from others, that about 2% of humanity has always been endowed with a great gift for programming computers, and that this ability long pre-existed its instrument. That is, he says at one point that the people who built the pyramids, some of them would have been great computer programmers if there'd been computers back then. And I dare say Paul English was one of that 2% when he first started out as a young programmer. With it came some problems in Paul's case. You know, he was diagnosed in his mid-20s with bipolar disorder. And I think for about 10 years, he was pretty much undefended from the illness, partly because he didn't like the usual antidote at the time. And so he suffered from terrible depressions, as well as these periods of what's called hypomania, which were nowhere near as painful to him, although they could have him working. I mean, he'd lose track of not just the hour, but of the day and sometimes the month, you know, while he was working.
What drew him to ultimately the founding of Kayak, but to programming in general? And how did that ultimately work for him, given that impairment?
Well, it started really when he went. He was a very bright working class kid. Pretty angry though. He scored very high on the citywide test to go to Boston Latin.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was eighth in the city. He was mad that he was only eighth. And when he got there, he decided he was never going to do any homework. But one of his first acts there was to join the computer club. And one of his first acts in the computer club came when he discovered that the instructor had a much richer menu than the students. And so Paul figured out a way to steal that menu, to steal the password and username. He invented what's called phishing for himself and got control of attendance so that he and his friends could play hooky for the next 7 years. It didn't help his academic standing much. From there, you know, I mean, it seems almost sort of natural, but there was a certain rocky road there, but it ended up with him being a programmer, and a programmer for a big company that was doing basically early document processing. While he was there, he went through a period where he didn't want anything to do with business. He was a programmer. He went through a transition where he became a manager, not a very good one at first, and then a better one, and then managing small groups and bigger and bigger and bigger groups, till finally he was one of a triumvirate who were running the company for a while, big company. And he went on from there, you know, had some disasters here and there, but he started creating companies. And in between creating company and selling them, and every time he did that, he'd always make sure that the people who were working for him got a good chunk of it, which made them very loyal to him. He has this tremendous cadre of people,
I'm sure.
So he bridged both worlds, and that's unusual. And that's not unknown, if God knows. I mean, someone like Gates, for instance, I dare say, is an even more shining example. One of the things that drew me to this guy is he's not famous. He's unusual, but he's, you know, he's not all covered with PR and so
right.
On. So he had this increasingly brilliant career at big jobs with companies like Intuit. He ran one day into a guy who, well, it was at a venture capital firm. I won't tell the whole story, but wanted to start this new kind of travel website, which would be instead of being a store, it would be more like a search engine. And that was Kayak. He worked his tail off and did some brilliant things. They both did. Both he and his co-founder was on the business side. And after 9 years, it was worth a lot of money. It was getting awfully big. And they had gone public. And I think it was too big for the likes of him anymore. He likes to start companies, not to run them.
One of the things that I thought was interesting in reading the book is that idea of how, yes, certainly not as famous as some others, but certainly known as the co-founder of Kayak. And with that does not come a great interest, perhaps, in the travel industry. It is it's the programming, isn't it?
Right. Well, I think you know, he always liked to travel, but he didn't have any particular interest in the travel industry. And I think that the great engineers who were working for him didn't either, really. I mean, this was a problem for
yes.
them to solve. How do we do this? You know, and there were plenty of problems to keep them interested. I think in the book I liken them to their shop was in Concord, Mass, and I liken them to the wheelwrights of, you know, I'm sure they weren't all that interested in travel either. They were interested in making better wagon wheels, and I think that's really, yeah, I think you got it.
The name of the book is A Truck Full of Money. Tracy Kidder is our guest. The book is published by Random House. I want to go back to something you said a moment ago in talking about Paul English and that idea of him being angry. Coming from Boston, and you address this in the book, this idea of class
mm-hmm.
and social class within Boston, and the term you use is the technological exception.
Right. Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, what I mean by that was that he's Boston Irish Catholic working class kid.
Yeah.
His father actually had risen to sort of middle management at Boston Gas. The way to rise, I mean, his great hero, maybe the best way to explain this is his great hero was a man named Tom White, Thomas J. White, who had been the enormous philanthropist for Partners in Health and Paul Farmer. And he and Paul English became great friends, like brothers across two generations, or like father and son, almost. A kid of the working class in Boston had a kind of hard road to hoe, you know, to get to the kind of place where Paul is now. But these programmers had a skill that was helping to produce enormous amounts of wealth. And their odd habits, their refusal usually to put on jackets and ties and stuff, were going to be tolerated, clearly. And you saw it, you know, I saw it when I was writing The Soul of a New Machine, although it didn't occur to me then, that, you know, outside Boston, you had these really rather ugly buildings being thrown up, you know, functional buildings, you know. And in fact, they were proud of the fact that they were so unadorned and so on, the people in that world. And these were the factories of this new computer age. And some of the workmen there were bound to rise just because of skill. So it was this was one instance where, I mean, I've never really believed that America was a meritocracy. So much depends on what your parents did and how you were, you know, born and raised and, you know, your economic class and so on. But I think in this case, this is different. If you have this kind of skill and you had some social skills, you could find your way to, you know, a very comfortable life, if not one of enormous prosperity. And we all know the stories of enormous prosperity that have come to people who qualified for this exception.
But you never get the idea in the telling of your story, at least I didn't, that's what he was looking for. It wasn't the wealth that he was looking for.
No, I don't think so. I think, in fact, wealth has made him very uncomfortable. It's not that he doesn't enjoy it. It's not that he's saying, oh, poor me, I'm rich. It's that, oh, God, you know, I mean, he said to me once, you know, it's a burden and an obligation, but mostly it's nice. But it is a burden and an obligation. And I mean, I remember of all many things, we talked about this a lot. One time he said, you know, growing up, I didn't have any money. So why do I get to have money? It just doesn't feel right to me. And he didn't study hard at Boston Latin, but he's very bright. And he believes in adult education. I mean, he's constantly reading and learning and so on. And he's traveled all over the world, particularly the poor parts of the world. He's done some really beautiful service in places like Africa. And I think he feels that money, you know, money has proper uses. Money is not in itself of worth anything. It's just a fiction, as Way also put it to me. It has to be moved around. Hoarding it is a disaster because that's not what money was made for. And so I think in his case, it was something that came along with something else that he wanted to do. And it's still that way with him. He likes making money for other people more, I think, than he does for himself. You know, at least at his best moments. I mean, he's like all of us. He has his ups and downs.
The title of the book, A Truck Full of Money, did that come from just the idea of having this money and then deciding what to do with it?
No, it came from a story. I think I said that he has a bunch of people who worked for him for 20 years and more who are either very skilled in programming or very good managers, and they would keep signing up for things that he'd done. Now, I can't remember exactly the details now, but a few guys had gone off and started their own little company, and they'd taken a break from Paul because he can be exhausting to work for. And it wasn't going very well. Paul was starting something new, and he came to see them, and he said, hey, you know, come on, guys, come with me now. And they said, well, we'll think about it. And they left. And one of these three is a guy named Bill O'Donnell, a truly amazing programmer, a very gifted manager. Actually comes from New England digital royalty. His mother was the vice president of and chief technical officer of two big computer companies, so that, which is really unusual. Anyway, Bill said to the other guys, said, look, you know, I'm sorry. I hate to leave you guys. You can have all my stock in this. I just don't think this is going anywhere. Says, I've got to go. I want to follow Paul. And I guess someone said, well, why? And he said, because someday this boy is going to get hit by a truck full of money and I'm going to be standing beside him. And so he was, in fact, when Kayak was sold. I like the title partly, I mean, or title with that story in there, because it's not, it's something you get hit by. It's not an unrelieved great thing. You know, it has its downside too, at least for this guy. And I just sort of like the way it sounds.
But you do get the idea in the book of how he, over time, embraces the philanthropy.
Oh, yeah. And I think he had for a long time. The first time he made some significant money and sold a little software company that he'd created, he had all of a sudden more money than he never dreamed of having, something on the order of $8 million before taxes. And he wanted to figure out how to give it away. And that's when he found his way to meeting this guy, Tom White, and getting advice. And I think from then on, it was just a matter of finding better and better ways to give money away, and then suddenly finding himself after the sale of Kayak with a great deal of money to give away, and you know, wanting to both to enjoy some of it. I mean, he loves cars, but also to begin to use it in a way that would help people in the world, you know, the people of the world, the poor of the world, the wretched of the earth. And I think, you know, he's really gotten in, he's gotten going now. But he wanted to do it. He's an engineer. He wanted to do it in the best possible way. I don't think for self-aggrandizing reasons. One of the things he likes to do and is doing, I think, regarding homelessness in Boston is to find people to invest in who know a lot more about something than he does and are, but who have a record of effectiveness, you know, in alleviating suffering, basically. I think that's his, the main thing he cares about.
Tracy Kidder is our guest. The name of the book is A Truck Full of Money, One Man's Quest to Recover from Great Success. When you meet him, he is just leaving Kayak, correct?
Yeah.
He's just leaving.
About to leave.
He's about to go. At what point did you, even in the writing and figuring out this story, that the story, yes, would be about him, yes, it would be about computers and computer programming, but it was also going to be very much the story of a man overcoming this illness?
I don't remember when I became aware that he had this illness, but as time went on, I mean, I spent a pretty much a solid year with him and then parts of the next 2 years. And during that time, toward the end, he was starting to get it under a bit under control. I mean, for the first time in an awfully long time. The hypomania, that is. The depression was really well controlled. It was right there in front of me, so it became part of the story. But I guess, in a more general sense, Joe, you know, the way I think of it is I was looking for, when I started out looking for a window on the world of high-tech, you know, software, the internet commerce, all that
right.
sort of stuff. And I found a good one in him. But it's always happened to me. Every book I've written, I found the window more interesting than the view. You know, and but the view is part of the of his, you know, it's the setting of the story. You know, it's the way I think of it is that I'm always more interested in the people that I'm writing about than in the world around them, than the ideas that are they might potentially embody. I'm not trying to write allegory. I'm not doing what some wonderful writers do, which is to write essentially about ideas, you know, and to use people just as examples. The people that come first for me, and then the things that preoccupy them, of course, preoccupy me. I mean, I couldn't write about Paul Farmer without writing about infectious disease and its distribution in the world. I couldn't write about Paul English without knowing something about programming and the world of, you know, high tech finance and so on. But those are, I don't know if I've said this right, but it's just part of a story. The essence of a story, the engine of any story, is the human being or a bunch of them.
Because it seems as though this idea of Kayak or any of the other software that he developed pales in comparison importance to him and to his story and what he overcame.
That's why I feel about it. I think that's probably true of all of us. I hope it is. Not in every case, I suppose, you know. I mean, it may be that there are people out there who create something much bigger than themselves and it outlives them and so on. I don't know if that would be said of him. He's not the same kind of figure as Paul Farmer might be. But you might say that of Paul Farmer. I expect that he will have created things that will long outlive him. I don't know about Paul English. I don't care so much about that. I'm interested in what has happened so far and in the life that it presents us. Really what I want is for readers to feel transported by a story that I'm telling them, taken somewhere interesting with a good companion, or a good bunch of companions. And I mean, that's what I think that the stories I admire most, the writers I admire most do that. That, you know, they make the world new again.
Do you think he still feels that the story is open-ended, his story, and that some of his greatest work and his greatest creations are in the future?
I think he might. I don't know. I mean, I can't speak for him. But yeah, he thinks it's open-ended. He has lots more to do.
Yeah,
it's very hard to know with Paul what he'll do tomorrow. I mean, he has a great gift for saying, okay, this isn't working. I'm going to turn aside from it. I don't think in either in the philanthropic case, however, I don't think he's going to do that. These are such worthy, sturdy, and important causes, and he's invested a great deal in them already, both in terms of energy and money. And I think those might be, but he doesn't want to build monuments to himself. You know, he was, one of the things he found most moving in recent economic history, high-tech economic, well, economic history, was the fact that Warren Buffett gave, you know, what was it, $22 billion to the Gates Foundation. Instead of building a monument to himself, he said, oh, there's a good organization here. I like this organization. Here, I'll have $22 billion. that was the kind of gesture Paul liked. I remember going to this wonderful hospital that Partners in Health built in Haiti, in a place called Mirbele. Brand new hospital, gorgeous place. The ICU is nicer than the one where my granddaughter was in Boston. And there's a wall of the donors there. The size of the donations kind of represented by the size of the circle on this thing, but most of them have names in them and some of them don't. And his one, which was a pretty big circle, had no name in it. And I think it's not that he has no ego or that he's some kind of perfect person, but that's not what he wants. He's not looking to build monuments to himself. He wants to alleviate suffering. I think that's what makes him feel good.
Is he interested in alleviating the suffering that is caused by mental illness?
Yeah, I can. I think it's okay to say this. Since this book was published, he's gotten an awful lot of emails from people who are suffering from bipolar. It's a mood disorder. And it's, by the way, I think an overdiagnosed illness. I think a lot of people have said that. But in many cases, it's a real thing. And also from, I think, a parent or two of people. He answers all those emails. And he's actually tried to work with some of the people who've called him. I mean, to get them to, say, suicide hotlines or... I mean, I don't want to embarrass anybody, but, that's the kind of guy he is. He's a really busy guy. He's got a brand new company that's, needs his every attention, but he's got time for that. I don't want it to seem romantic. It's a tremendously painful illness. There's a description in there of what his depressions were like. It's really quite staggering. I think most recently, though, it was partly the influence, of a woman, a good woman, who got him thinking seriously about trying to control hypomania a little more. Hypomania is an odd thing. As he once said to me, one of the problems is that when we're hypomanic, we tend to wonder what it is that needs to be cured. It feels good. It does have its liabilities, and he recognizes those. And he's had therapists and psychiatrists who help him, but I think these are acts of will. I mean, the one thing that he was born... So he's born with this illness, presumably. He was also born... with a kind of, or develop the kind of personality that says, this is a problem, I'm going to deal with this problem. He's an engineer, and an engineer of souls, maybe, or at least of his own.
Do you think that the way he looks at it, and I don't want to, I certainly don't want to oversimplify this, but again, you look at it through the eyes of an engineer that, okay, here's a problem that I can fix as a software developer, and this is a problem that I can fix using the sources that are here.
Right. I think that's right. Let's see what's available, but if it's not available, let's see if we can find it. But he hasn't dedicated his life to, to bipolar disorder research or anything like that. That I don't know. I haven't asked him why, but it's not that he's not interested. He's a great believer in talk therapy and then psychiatry. The thing that really sticks with me, I remember one night that we were out with this homelessness doc, this dedicated doctor. Paul met a homeless guy who had bipolar disorder too. And sitting on the bench with this guy and just talking with him, I was there, but Paul later told me that, what was in his mind. And he was saying, I was thinking about the accidents of life and, what little changes would have to be made for me to be in his place. Caused him to reflect a bit on something that he'd been hearing in the last couple of years. And he'd tell people, friends, that his kayak fortune made him feel uncomfortable. And a few of them had said pretty much the same thing, not all, but just, you shouldn't feel that way. You worked hard for your money. And he heard two things in that. First was, is the insinuation that poor people wouldn't be poor if they weren't lazy, which he doesn't believe. The second one was, truth is, I didn't work all that hard. I'm just good at something that makes a lot of money.
Yeah.
And when have you heard that from a high-tech entrepreneur? I mean, it's not just seemly, it's true. He is just happens to be good at something that makes a lot of money.
The name of the book is A Truck Full of Money, One Man's Quest to Recover from Great Success. It's by Tracy Kidder. It's published by Random House. Tracy, always a pleasure to have you on the program. What a delight.
Oh, thank you, Joe. It's good to see you again.
Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.